Executive Breakthroughs Podcast with your host, Jason Troy, executive coach and best-selling author. Get game-changing strategies and tactics from the world's most successful executives and entrepreneurs about how they build and grow 8-, 9-, and 10-figure businesses, hire, manage, and develop A-level talent, create a culture to skyrocket success, build an extraordinary network out of influencers, and so much more. Stay tuned for mistakes you can skip and strategies you can steal, because stealing pens and post-it notes is for amateurs. It's time for another massive breakthrough, Executive Breakthroughs with Jason Troy.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Executive Breakthroughs. Thanks for joining us this week and hope you had an extraordinary day. Today on the show, Brent Brightwell joins us, and he's the Senior Vice President of Products and Strategies with Double Horn in Austin. He's been in the technology industry for a long time. He's had a fantastic career starting out with his first job, which we'll be talking about, which is really interesting how he got that. He got to work along some really well-known people at Marimba Software, Kim Palese, who is very famous that he worked with back in the late 90s and early 2000s in Silicon Valley. He's had, you know, high-level experiences working at HP and BMC Software. And I think you're going to find this interview is going to give you a lot of nuggets and a lot of great quotes that you will sit back and reflect on. So without further ado, let's hop right into the show.
I'm with a fantastic guest on today's podcast show, Brent Brightwell, and he is going to drop a lot of great nuggets on you from his career and leadership and all the things that he's learned. And he has had a varied career going from startup to massive company to now we're going to talk about where he is today. And, you know, one of the things, if you go look at his LinkedIn, that I thought really stood out other than a lot of the different things he's been doing and success he's had, is the recommendations and people on his LinkedIn talked about, you know, his caring, his mentorship, and his servant leadership. And I thought when you look through, you know, some 60 plus recommendations that people have given, that and those things consistently stand out. I mean, he's had a major impact on a lot of people. So I'm really excited to have you on the show today.
Wow. Well, thanks for having me. That felt wonderful. Can you do that every day, or I'll just listen to the podcast again?
You could just listen to the podcast. So could you tell people, you know, talk about growing up. Where did you grow up and what kind of family did you have? Because I think it's interesting to talk about people's background and their progression.
Sure. Happy to. Yeah, I grew up in Northeast Texas, in a town probably no one's ever heard of called Beckville, Texas. 904 people.
Where is that near?
It's near, it's right near the Sabine River, near Marshall, Tyler. It's kind of right there on the edge of Louisiana and Texas. You know, we were there to protect the border, all borders. We didn't do a very good job, but it was a nice, small, sweet little town. And both my mom and my dad's whole families was raised and born there, came there, you know, in the early 1900s. Around the time of the oil boom in Overton and so on, and they never left. Just myself and my brother and a few others have actually left and moved on to bigger cities.
Wow. So what did your dad or your parents do for work? Or?
Yeah, my dad worked in the oil and gas industry, which is still a predominant industry there in East Texas. And he worked for Eastman Kodak as well, which was a larger employer there, more on the mechanical and engineering side. My mom mostly worked in service industry and raising the kids. My dad had a hobby farm, and that's where I started my work. Hobby farm in East Texas, other than being a great tax break, is bringing in, you know, cows and horses and breeding them and then selling off the ones that can pay for the next batch. And it really becomes just a hobby more than it is a functional farm. But you need workers, and that's where I started at a very young age, you know, making sure that they got fed and they got cleaned and the fences were mended and hay was made. So I started very early on working in a very physical aspect on a hobby farm for my dad for no money, just because that's what he wanted me to do.
Was there any lesson that you look back that you learned working on the
farm that taught me that, you know, it's very hot in Texas and cold in the winter and hot in the summer, that I, as soon as I turned 16, I need to get an air conditioning job, which I did. But it did instill a work ethic in me that, you know, my days for almost every summer, as long as I could remember, started out, you know, very early with, you know, doing the more labor intensive stuff during the cooler times of the morning and, in the evenings, and being flexible, getting plenty of sleep and making sure you're strong and aware, and learning how to use heavy equipment, learning how to drive at a very young age. And I'll say, you know, 10, 11 starting out, and did that up until I was 16. But it was very important for him to have someone like me helping him, because it wasn't a fully functioning farm he could depend upon. So I had to be very responsible and accountable with the equipment and making sure everything was maintained. And that helped me learn a lot, but also just gave me a lot of accountability to make sure that, you know, these living creatures need to stay, you know, living and fed, and things were taken care of from him. And he gave me good guidance and direction for it. But I did, hate those hot summers. I don't handle the heat well. So as soon as I got 16, you know, and could be W-2'd, I went and found my first real job.
Right. Yeah. So what event growing up really played a big role? Like, was there, usually a lot of people, there's an event that really shaped or formed them, you know, before you got to college. Was there?
Yeah. Well, there's a series of events, you know, and oftentimes they cascade into unusual and unpredictable areas. My parents split up pretty early, and I was with my mom, my brother was with my dad. So a lot of the time I spent with my father was weekends, holidays, and summer and vacation breaks, and I spent most of that with him and working. And they would go on to, you know, remarry multiple times. And that taught me a lot about loyalty and making sure I'm responsible for picking my children's parents. They don't get to pick that, so make sure I pick a good one. They pick terrible in each other and the next three. So I made sure later on in life when I picked my spouse, I made sure I picked the right mother for my kids. That was probably the biggest thing. Watching how they got along and did not help me build out not only just the loyalty, but how to communicate and how to deliver communications and news information in the right way at the right time, and respect and loyalty. Those were very important, because sometimes those were anti-role models growing up. And when it came to integrity and making sure that you do what you say, I was often let down, and I didn't want to be that type of person, you know, to others. So I've always held myself very accountable for making sure that I under-promise, over-deliver, and do what I say, and then always help people. You know, one great thing I can say about my mom and my dad is they were what we would call consummate networkers. They were always meeting new people. And my dad would always say, you know, meet as many people as you can, because you never know who you're going to need in life. And this is a small East Texas person, but that networking skill has served me very well, and always give more. And I think you mentioned that on my LinkedIn. Now that I think about it, that is a pervasive thing that I didn't recollect, but I'm proud of, is that helping people and doing more for people is very important to me.
And you learn that early on. Sometimes we learn that the opposite way and not directly from someone mentoring us. And we see the things that we want, and then we project them into our lives.
Yeah. You always believe, oh, wow, that's what that family must be like. I want that someday, or this could be this way. And those wishes and those hopes become inculcated and instilled in us as values that we strive towards, even if we're lacking them. So a lot of people say, well, my environment led to, you know, my drug habit or alcohol or whatever, because I grew up in that. Well, sometimes people break that cycle, and how they do it is by looking how it could be and have a vision for the future and then striving towards it and not allowing yourself to be not focused from that goal.
So how did you get in the technology world?
Oh, wow.
I always wonder that, how people get on the path that they have, because obviously you've gone down a lot of different roads in the technology world, but how did you get in that first foray of really learning about technology and then just getting your first job?
Well, I've always had an affinity for technology and sci-fi and fantasy, and grew up reading comic books and loving those great movies and Star Wars and so on. But just like I pivoted from farming to what I called an air conditioning job, I went into retail because that was the easiest and quickest job. Actually, how I got my first job is kind of interesting. And it says a lot probably about how I got my last job or my next job, resourcefulness. You know, I knew I wanted to go work in a more climate-friendly environment. So at age 14, I went to all the local grocery stores in the town next to me. And they all, you seem like a bright kid, you know, but you're too young. You got to come back when you're older. And the company I spotted that I really wanted to work for was Winn-Dixie at the time. I liked their store. I liked their people, I liked their prices. And that's where I want to be, you know, in any capacity. So what I did, that following summer is I'd go borrow, I call it borrow, watermelons from the Preston place. He always had too many anyway, and load them up during the night with my friends. And the next morning, that summer morning, I'd drive up to the Winn-Dixie parking lot and go inside and see how much, they had their watermelons on sale for and mark mine a half price and sell them and then use that money to, you know, pay my friends to help me the next night. Well, Mr. Bardwell was the store manager for that Winn-Dixie. And I'll never forget after about 2 weeks of doing that, him coming out and had a big old deep, boy, you're killing my watermelon business. What is it going to take for me to get you out of here? You know, so give me a job. He said, you're hired, you know, and then I told him my age. He said, well, come back on January 5th when you turn 16 and I'll hire you. And to his credit, he did. He hired me on January 5th, started on the 6th. And, I would move on to, do lots of interesting jobs through, they gave me a lot of promotions and, you know, minimum wage was $3, but by the time I left, I was at $9. I just had a great successful career, but they ended up closing down and, I had to go work at another neighboring store and moved around a little bit, ended up at an HEB in College Station while I was going to school. All this time still having that affinity for technology and doing things like, helping my barber, you know, network his computers or helping, you know, somebody, you know, reformat a hard drive and things like that. So I was doing this as more of a hobby while I was working in retail. And after 8 years of retail and working my way through high school, junior college, and then college, I decided it's time to make a move. And I want to turn my hobby into a career. And that's when I left the retail business. I was doing very well, making very good living. But I was kind of climbing the ladder of the wrong, you know, leaning against the wrong tree. I went back and got some certification. I started networking with people in technology. This was happening in Houston during the boom time of internet service providers growth. We had hundreds of internet service providers before the big AOL, consolidation. And, I met some guys who had a small consulting company and they needed a guy who could do sales and marketing. And that's what I'd done a lot of in my, retail career. And, at the same time, I needed to learn how to do technology implementations, consulting, and we kind of paired up. And for the next almost 2 years, that's what we did exclusively. We went around to and built and modernized, internet service providers or data centers. We were really good at sales and marketing. We were very good at doing the implementations. We were terrible at collecting the money. We needed a CFO, our accounts, you know, accounts receivable person. And cash flow is king in small businesses. So we ended up getting acquired, by our largest customer, a company called Comworks, a play on Compact, which was, it was the ISP near the Compact campus and was supplying all those homes and a lot of those businesses that were supporting Compact. We would take that business and grow it from a handful of customers and no business users to about 300 business users and probably 3,000 end users. And it ultimately get acquired by Earthlink, which was my kind of my first acquisition. At that same time, I was looking at, I'd done network engineering, system admin. I'd done a lot of that kind of deep in the GORP stuff, but I really had the affinity for product marketing, outbound marketing, you know, interfacing with customers. So I started exploring. And at the time, I didn't know what this was, but becoming a product manager. I assumed every product had somebody over, but I didn't know what a product manager was. And this is the late 90s.
So what do you, I mean, that's a pretty big curiosity. And obviously you've had that being innovative and curious, you know, from selling watermelons all the way up. Mm-hmm. Again, is that something that like you just started to instilled in you as something that you just looked every time? Like, I want to look and see something new that I could be doing and innovating. Cause even in these jobs, you're getting, you know, you're rotating in different positions mm-hmm. and you're learning areas that you don't know.
Yeah. Well, curiosity is a good quality to call out because it does can be perceived as someone who moves around too much. It also can happen is they've made themselves open and available and excelling at what they're doing to take on more span of control, to get more responsibility. And that's generally what happens to me. I'm a very helpful person by nature and enjoy doing volunteer work and helping others. And something like a product manager is a great role to do because you need everyone's help to get what you need done in your product. So if you ever want to monetize a volunteer attitude, service attitude, becoming a product manager is a great way to do it. But to your point, you know, that movement and growth came out of curiosity of wanting to grow and do more and learn more, having an insatiable appetite to expand, right? My knowledge and capabilities and skills. And I didn't know at the time, but product management was something that was in high demand. It was extremely high demand and need with the dot-com explosion that was happening at the time in the late 90s. It was roles that were being very defined and highly valued in technology. And when you put yourself out there and you're curious and you're learning, there's things that are going to attract you and tickle your ears. And the way business physics works, they will find you. And I just happened to bump into at an event at a company called Marimba that I'd never heard of. I knew it was a musical instrument. This was one of those hot internet companies started by the team that was at Sun that ran Oak, the product manager and her development team, which was Java. And they broke away, got some money from Kleiner Perkins, and went and started Marimba to apply, you know, Java to internet technologies. And they had done real well in their core business, and now were expanding. And they wanted to go into, you know, hamburger, they want a pizza. Change of configuration management was good for them. Now they want to go into performance management. And they strategically hired away a team from BMC Software there in Houston, which is where I was living after I left my home in East Texas. I went to College Station to school and then moved to Houston for the next 8 years. And that's where I would meet these guys at an event. And these bright purple shirts on that said Marimba, and they were talking tech. And I was like, wow, this is fascinating. Tell me more. And I knew just enough about Java to be starstruck that these founders came from that and worked on that. And what they ultimately said, and this was the chief architect and more the development people they kind of taken away from BMC. Marimba was based in the Bay Area, literally right behind the Netscape campus, right in the heart of what's going on in Mountain View in the Silicon Valley. And they'd taken this team away from BMC, essentially taking the key author and a few others who were ready to move, you know, and spun this up. But they're all technologists and they needed a business person. They needed a salesperson. And ultimately what they said was they need a product manager. You know, what's a product manager? And then that's where the formalization of understanding, oh, this is what I am. But until that time, I couldn't quite identify, am I a salesperson? Am I a marketing person? Am I an engineer? No, I'm a product person. Product can be services or whatever they may be. Innovate, solve problems, help people, find problems that are urgent and pervasive and people will spend money on today. That's what I do. And I got to join those guys. And that was my first true software technology, I'd call it, you know, role as a product manager for a hot company. And I'd go on to do that many times over, but that was a very interesting company.
What did you learn working there? What were the main takeaways when you were at this?
Well, I mean, so there's a lot, but one of the first ones, you know, I learned, I didn't understand my value or the market value when it came to people and how important technologists were to technology. When I went through the interview process and I'm interviewing with, you know, the key executives at Marimba and then start talking to people at the board level, like Ray Lane, who's running the board. I don't know who they were from Adam. They didn't know me from Adam. And at the end of the day, the guy that was hiring me, Robert Moss, said, okay, well, what do you think would be a fair compensation? Or what do you want? And at the time, $60,000. That'd be great. $60,000, which was about 20-30% more than I'd made in retail. And I thought that would be a fair. He came back through our video conferencing and said, we're going to offer you 90 and we're going to throw all these shares at you. And I was like, why? I mean, why? And I didn't understand that exactly until I got to the Bay Area the next week for my onboarding. And as I was getting dropped off by the taxi there at the campus and saw all these recruiters taped off who were throwing business cards at people as they walked into the building and the Netscape building and others trying to recruit people. And when I got inside and got to meet Kim Pelosi and Arthur Van Hoff and Ray Lane and my boss, Robert Ma, I said, oh, now I get it. And they're like, yeah, you're too strategic as an individual. We can't have you jumping ship over compensation. And we want you here for the long haul. And that's where the stock and the equity positions come in.
You undervalued yourself. And why do you think that was? You didn't understand how to figure out value? Or do you just think that you didn't think that you were worth it?
I didn't understand the business economics of technology. I had an affinity for technology. I had used technology. I'd implemented technology, but I didn't understand. It's like liking a movie, enjoying actors, knowing who directors are, but not knowing the movie business. That was the first thing. It was ignorance. And that was a great education in how to do that. And how it applied to me, it hit me right in the flesh with a valuation of myself. And I'd later go on to understand not just the technology and the technologists, but how to evaluate companies, how to evaluate companies I'm buying, when I'm getting bought. It was a great education early on.
Right. And you're applying that obviously now.
I've applied it throughout amongst many things throughout my career.
So from Marimba, where was the next step?
Yeah. So Marimba was a great opportunity to learn what it meant to be a product manager by doing something the wrong way. Okay. You know, a product manager, you often hear them called the CEO of the product, but really they're responsible for everything that it takes to get a product to market and be successful. And they usually have no direct reports. They're dependent upon everyone else. You got to have great diplomacy skills. You got to have a helpful nature. You got to be nice. You know, people don't like helping, you know, more bees with honey.
Yes.
And then you have to do the fundamentals of product management. Well, understanding, you know, maybe the pragmatic marketing framework is something I would adopt later. And when I came into Marimba, I did not know that space, that performance management space. I didn't have any domain expertise, but this team I was working with did, and they were so smart. They knew exactly what they're doing. They knew exactly who they wanted to be. And they had a big, beautiful roadmap, what we now call boiling the ocean. And, I kind of came in and was so wild with it and not understanding what my true role was. I need to be more independent and really do use my own judgment and ascertain, you know, the primary and secondary research and really be more of a challenger to that. But I didn't. They're smart. They get it. Let's just go execute. I picked up my sword and shield, marched with Native and went right along with them. And we had a big, beautiful roadmap. We started coding towards it. And we were going to take on the company at the time was Mercury Interactive. And of course, BMC across the street, you know, this little company with this little startup taking on these $1 billion. And, we were bowling the ocean, but we've got three great customers or we'll call them prospects, people who could become customers if we delivered what we said we were going to deliver. And, one of them was Enron, the primary, and then there was Dynegy, and there was another one, we owns Energy. And we started building out and working with them, getting them ready for beta. And then something macro happened. That's when the dot bomb hit. And Marimba being at the heart of the Bay Area, they were like a canary in the coal mine. They were the first ones that sensed it, right? And at that time, my new boss and CEO named Rich Wyckoff, I'll never forget when he called me, he said, "Hey, Brent, you know, hamburger business is now getting tough. I don't know if we can stay in the pizza business. I don't know if we can continue this. But if you can tell me that y'all have one customer and give us $1, I can convince the board to keep this going." And I said, "Wow, Rich, that's horrible news, but I've got three customers and they're going to give us a lot of dollars, but we're still 6 months away from delivering minimal viable product to those." He said, "But you don't have one, then give one today." I said, "No." I said, "Okay, we got to shut it down." And at the time I didn't realize that was my fault. You know, if we blame the company didn't get it. We blame the economy. You know, they were too short-sighted and everything. I would go on to realize years later as I learned how to become a product manager by going native and going along with them, I didn't really do my job, which was to make sure that we built something that could get to market and be successful and not try to bowl this ocean to compete against all these people we wanted to beat. And as a result of not doing my job, and no one blamed me at the time, but I blame myself heavily ever since then. You know, 16 good people lost their jobs, people who had mortgages, people who had college funds, people who had, you know, responsibilities.
And how did that affect you?
Well, at the time, I was like them. I was, you know, blaming others. It wouldn't be about 2 years later till I was introduced to some really strong product management mentorship and going through the pragmatic marketing model for training for product management, product marketers, that I realized what I did wrong. And it became my life case study in a discussion to every product manager I've ever hired since then. This is what you have to do, or else this can be the as a product manager, you can get a lot of resources spun up. You can go out and do a lot of things and get a lot of investment going, and something can happen. And if it fails, you're ultimately responsible for it. And if I would have been, you know, hindsight 2020, I would have gone focused on not bowling the ocean, but modular components and built that out as a roadmap and delivered something within that year and got $1 from that one customer, and we'd have still stayed in business. So that became a great case study for product management for myself that I could apply, but also tell to every product manager that it is your responsibility. Even if it's a micro or macro economic event, if you don't do your job as a product manager, you're not solving problems that are urgent, pervasive, and people will spend money on today, and you're not boiling the ocean and trying to build out this massive thing, you can fail. You can be subject to that because there's never enough time. There's never enough money. There's never enough resources. You got to get something out. I would then go on after Marimba. It was kind of serendipitous. While I was out doing some analyst road shows, I would bump into another company who was doing a similar road show at the time, talking to analysts. I would just be one analyst ahead of them. And each time they would go to the next analyst that trailed me, they would say, "Hey, you need to talk to this guy." And this is some guys from TL Ventures here in Austin. They'd funded a company called Matrix Net Systems, a company that was doing kind of monitoring of all the internet, wrote the book, The Matrix, long before there was the movie Matrix. And they were basically mapping. If you ever saw any where the internet lies, these guys were out there doing it. And they wanted to take that and monetize it. So they had invested, TL Ventures invested in it. And, enough analysts told them they should be talking to me. And so they picked up the phone and called me and recruited me about the same time that things were. They did want me to move to California. It was my first time of many to get pushed to move to California. I've spent most of my career working for Bay Area companies. And Marimba did offer me and want me to come to California, and I didn't want to leave Austin. I thought it was a great city and great town, great technology town as well. So this gave me an opportunity not only to leave Houston, come to Austin, but also to try my hands at another startup. And that was Matrix. And that was a very interesting company going through, new CEO, new management team.
And you wanted to go to another startup? And so what attracted you to that type of environment?
Up until then, other than working retail for huge billion-dollar companies, my affinity has always been for the scrappy startup, take on the big guys. I like being an ankle biter, taking, the littlest dog can hike his leg on the biggest building, that kind of thing, and taking on the big guys. Now, as I would go through this process of my career, I always was going to school. It's important to remind people that, continuous education and self-funding education was always important to me.
And why was that?
Well, I knew I had to get, I always had a desire and just a passion to learn and grow. And, really between my years was what was going
to
make
it. Did you have someone as a mentor or anyone else that was ahead of you?
A few along the way. At that time, not as much. But growing up, I could clearly see as a young boy, those who were educated, how they progressed better than those who weren't. But I also saw the price of stupidity mistakes. So throughout my high school years, my junior college, my college years, I was always working full time. I never stopped working, full time salary, 40 to 60 hours. So that always made it challenging for grades and homework, but it was just built into me. So as I went and finished up another advanced degree or an IS degree in business and then would go and work on an MBA, I would do that while I was working. And so these startups were like my lab. At night I'd be working on my MBA and weekends and then working during the week and be able to apply that. So it's very helpful in market planning, business planning, because I got to apply what I was learning in school right away. It never impacted my employment because I was able at the time, technology allowed me to do a lot more distance learning or remote learning with minimal residency. I'd have to do some, but then I would go when I needed to, usually during vacation.
And so it's built back in your hard work ethic. Because obviously you're working a lot in the startup and having to go to school. There's only so many hours in a day.
You get acclimated to it though. And what ends up happening when you stop doing that, which I would do when we start having children, that just got filled up with taking care of kids. So you just get acclimated at running at that pace.
How'd you find your wife in all of this?
Yeah. Well, that happened. Actually, that pivotal moment to move to Austin, I'd met my wife a few months earlier. She was at Enron. And wonderful, wonderful, wonderful person. It was exactly, I'd spent many dates looking for the right mother, my children, good wife. And she fit it perfectly.
Well, what did she fit?
Yeah. So she fit, almost think of it like a, now it's pretty commonplace to profile, non-smoker, this, and this. She fit my check boxes perfectly.
What,
and I was very clear.
What was at the top of the list?
I was really looking for someone. I felt like I had a desire to learn more about spirituality and religion, and she fit that. She was very religious and spiritual, and she could inculcate. I felt like that was missing from my childhood, and that would have helped a lot more with the family dynamics. She fit that she was extremely smart. She's the smartest and most wisest person I've ever met in my life, and I've met some people who call themselves geniuses, very wise person. She could keep up and get. I love to joke and laugh and cut up, and she laughs at those and enjoys them, and then tells me, you know, things that we need, like, hey, don't wear that, or you need to cut your hair, or, you know, she really keeps me in check. But she's very loyal. And she proved that by saying, you know what, I'm going to quit my job at Enron, back when Enron was on top of their game, and perceivably on top of their game. And we're getting married and we're moving to Austin. And we did that, you know, and, about 7 months later, Enron would collapse. That would impact Matrix, because Matrix had Enron as a customer as well. But she showed me that she was willing to be a part of what I was going to do. And she bought into my plan and she wanted to be a part of it.
And she was all in.
She was all in. And she's never, every day she reinforces it with her actions and her words, but she was always in. And that level of loyalty and support has allowed me to go and work hard, because she takes care of me and takes care of our family.
Did you see that? Around. I mean, growing up, you necessarily didn't have that in terms of role models of people that were all in. So that's obviously something that you wanted, that stability support of someone that was going to be there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through thick and thin.
Yeah, I mean, what I call her
is bail when times got tough, right? Because you saw that growing up, that's what happened over and over again.
Yeah, lack of loyalty and really giving in to people, their own selfish desires, is something I witnessed over and over. And it was always disheartening, because usually came at the expense of someone. And when you're a child, usually if it's your parents, it comes at the expense of the children, right? When they put themselves first. So I knew what I wanted and how I wanted to be, and what type of person I wanted to be, and what that would allow me to attract in a mate. I had to be a good mate to attract a good mate. And that her qualities really shined in that area, and they still always do. And I would tell her she's the million and one girl. You know, if I let this one go, the next one will be a million girls away, and I don't have that kind of time or effort and energy. And she was that perfect fit. And she helped me, you know, as an executive assistant who really runs a lot of the businesses. She did that for Enron very well for almost a decade. You know, she helped me in that regard. She helped me understand business politics. She helped me understand business dynamics, you know, business ethics. You know, she had seen a lot and done very well. And she never regretted a day leaving Enron, although she felt like it could be a great company if it had been under different management. But she and I together became a very solid core that allowed me to, and we made the decision. She was going to be a stay-at-home wife and mom. She comes from an old Latina family. So that was something that she felt like that she'd like to do. We're going to have one parent full-time and another that would be work. So that sacrifice of, you know, one income, but we'll make it happen, which means we need to invest in my education more. We need to make smarter business decisions. That would ultimately, a few years later, when we started having kids, she'd say, hey, dude, we got to get a real job with our big company now. I mean, this insurance and these companies getting bought or sold or going out of business, this is too erratic. You know, go find a bigger, better, you know, more stable job. And that would help my decision making when I ended up at BMC and later HP. But with Matrix, that really got me into, so I was running product management, product marketing. It helped me understand a lot about the product management fundamentals. I started getting introduced to training and really paying very close attention to how the CEO runs the business, and then how that model works for running your product line. CEO, you know, but your best product managers can become great CEOs, because they interface with all parts of the business and the customer and, of course, know the product and the technology. And you've got to have those diplomacy skills and communication skills and integrity skills that are inherent to a good CEO. Later on, I would go and start up my own company after Matrix. Matrix would later go on to get acquired by our number one competitor. It would go through some tough times, though, after Enron collapsed. It would hurt the business, and they kind of get picked up in a fire sale. But I would go and start my own business, and then that didn't turn out so well. Made some key business bad decisions, my partners and I. At that time, you know, this is now in the 2003, 2004. People are cut all their investment in R&D and technology and products in the 2000s because of dot-bomb to be competitive. Now they were dusting themselves off, ready to invest in R&D. And our business model was, we were going to have a bunch of enabling technology that we could OEM license to them if they didn't want to have to, you know, ramp up big R&D team or go buy a company. They could just take hours. No interface, no documentation, no customers, just enabling technologies that quickly, rapidly to get them into the market, like an advanced solutions group and an R&D team. And we were absolutely spot on the most of the technologies, enabling technologies we built, and the fact there would be a high desire by these companies once they dust themselves off and looked around and said, all right, we're ready to go again. What we didn't anticipate is they would see these technologies as strategic, and they'd want to acquire them versus license them. And when you're talking about licensing enabling technology, it's got a great value for the investment we've made. When you're talking about getting acquired, well, you have no customers. You don't have a UI. You know, you don't have documentation. This is how much I have on my credit card. The valuation is very different.
Yes.
So we could not get the type of, we got pulled into all these acquisition conversations versus royalty OEMs. They did not want to see us selling like software arms dealers to their competitors. So they want to take us out and bring us in. And we could never get the valuations to what our investors wanted. So ultimately, we struggled there. And I would depart and we start having kids and end up going to work for bigger companies after that.
So talk about the progression going to bigger companies, because you went into BMC and then HP. And
yeah, I'd make a couple of little false starts in those, a couple more small companies before the big one. While I was working on my MBA during that time, you know, if you play baseball as a kid, you want to play for the Yankees. That's your Yankees is the ultimate, right? If you're in technology and you're in business at that time and growing up, it was, for me, it was HP. They were my Yankees, and I always wanted to work for HP. I really believed in the Bill and Dave way and the HP way, and really studied them, wrote a lot of my case studies. I had a great professor at Regis who came from HP, and I was just a big believer in that company. So I had set my sights on, at the time, what I thought was the biggest and best. So I was not interested in working for, you know, the Googles or the Yahoos or those kinds of guys. I always focused on, you know, HP. And BMC was a great path to that. The CTO, Tom Bishop, another local executive here in town, used to be the CTO of Tivoli, worked a lot at IBM. He was part of networking and got to know. He was the CTO of BMC, and he recruited me in. I came in and took over a product line that was in distress and turned it around, got a lot more responsibility, ended up launching to the market a product around the Atrium product line, which ended up being a market-defining product that actually did real well in the space. And I spent almost 4 years there in a product management, product marketing, go-to-market capacity. And in doing that, I really honed my product management skills. I really honed, you know, my product build skills and pricing and positioning and messaging.
And working at a bigger company doing it.
You know, a billion-dollar company, very successful in past mainframe and then later client server, and now moving into, with the acquisition of Remedy and a few other key technologies, into the broader IT service management, IT operations management. I became a thought leader in that space with some specialty and some core technologies. Got to work a lot with the analyst. Don't always an analyst work, but this one I was really embedded because we made a good investment with those analysts and made some great relationships. And I got to compete and win. And I got to set the market with this technology around Atrium and be the market leader. And that was a great position to be in, both from as a product manager, because you want to have winners and you have big winners. And that was a big winner for me at the time. It also got me a lot of attention from our competitors that we were winning. And HP was trying to build out in the software portfolio a parallel competing interest to BMC under Tom Hogan, who reported to Mark Hurd at the time. And Tom Hogan's a local Central Texas-based CEO and had run Vignette, and he has now taken over HP Software. He had acquired Opsware, which kind of got the Andreessen, you know, Hurwitz guys in. He had taken over Peregrine, which was the Remedy competitor. He'd taken over Mercury Interactive and brought that in. And it was the Mercury Interactive guys who I'd started competing with years before at Marimba, who knew me well and got to see what I was doing because I was giving them grief at BMC and their product portfolio. So it was a competitive hire. You know, Tom and the senior management found me and said, come do what you're doing, integrate, make us like what BMC is.
And let's take them out. One of your goals is to end up working there. So it all really came together.
Oh man, it was a dream. I get to play for the Yankees. I get to understand and be a part of and live the HP way.
And so tell me how it was going to HP, because you got your dream. And, you know, oftentimes we get our dreams and they're not really what we think that they are or what we want.
Yeah. There's been many times I've come into companies where they, you know, it's been overpromised, you know, the technology has been overhyped and without being able to pull up the hood and it's, you know, cobwebs and duct tape. With HP, there were remnants of the HP way. You can't take that out, what Bill and Dave built and Lou Platt reinforced all those years. You never take that out. But under that time, it was Mark Hurd. Mark Hurd was very financially, you know, fiscally responsible, very focused on driving up the stock price and valuation and beholden to the shareholders, which means he ran very tightly by Excel spreadsheet and did things like, you know, let's sell the buildings, burn the furniture and kick all the employees out and they can work from home, you know. But he was very much focused on the P&L and the bottom line and growing top line revenue growth through those acquisitions. And when things went awry for him, which kind of happened in one of many HP scandals,
yes,
there was a major turnover. And in my first 3 years, it was phenomenal because we were growing. I got to take on a great product line. They gave me a lot of span control. One time I had 14 direct reports, thousands of people reporting to me. My products were just doing great. A lot of innovation. And with Mark Hurd's departure, subsequently, all of those who work with him or are part of his team, whether it be Randy Mott or Tom Hogan, they subsequently left too. So my sponsorship and the people that I worked with and was brought in under and empowered by all left. So I had a key decision to make. Do I go to and join my friends elsewhere, or do I stay and stick it out and whatever? And they, to HP's credit, you know, the HR leadership came to me, and leadership and development team said, well, we value what you want to do and what can we do to keep you? And I told them, well, you know, my goal is to be a CEO someday of a small company or maybe a GM of a bigger business unit. I said, great. Let's put you on a program. Let's groom you and nurture you to do that. And you've shown success. And let's now take that and make the case. So they created a program leveraging me. And they had me kind of fill out what do I think it takes to get there versus what they think it takes to get there, and with the goal of maybe taking over a $1 billion business unit in 18, 24 months. I've only been a product guy for the last several years, decade. I said, I really need to go run a sales team. I need to get that sales experience. I need to do more regional marketing outside my comfort zone of the Americas and get into parts of APJ or Europe and a few other things. So they gave me those opportunities. I got to go run a sales team.
The great thing is you had this vision and then you knew the pieces that you had to put together. And a lot of people don't. They just keep doing what they're doing or not really thinking ahead of what it's really going to take in order to get to that next place.
Well, that comes from what you mentioned earlier, mentors. And I was introduced early on at BMC to someone called Patty Azzarello. Patty Azzarello was a HP leader who ran HP software many years before Tom Hogan took it over. And a lot of people at BMC at the time used to work for her. They left HP, you know, and she came under Bill and Dave and she worked for Lou Platt and she was just a phenomenal leader. Probably, I think she was the youngest GM at HP that ever been promoted. And I was introduced to her as a part of a leadership and development program that she was doing with BMC. I would go on to spend a lot more time with her.
What did you learn from her?
Oh, wow. So many key things.
What was one of the main lessons that
I'll tell you with the story. I was sitting across from Jim Grant, giving a big presentation and pitch. Jim Grant was our general manager at BMC about what Atrium needed to be and how we needed to go about it. And, him and all the key people were there making the decision. I was giving the pitch and he said something to me about halfway through and said, Brent, you need to get off the S. And I heard, Brent, you need to get off your ass. So I stood up and started over. He said, no, you got to get off the S. The situation. I get the situation. Now I need you to start talking about what is our responses and what we're going to do to meet your desired outcome. Something he referred to as SRO. What is that? So as a part of my next promotion, they put me through the career development training, which Patty was leading. And one of her many things is SRO. Describe the situation, but don't collectively sit there and admire it. What are our responses to it to reach your desired outcome? She taught me how to be outcomes focused. No one cares about how much you work, how hard you work, whatever. Focus on the outcome. Focus on the things that you committed to. They're going to make the biggest impact of the business. And I would spend, just like I spent with the pragmatic marketing framework, learning how to hone product management, product marketing skills, I would spend the next, and still do, as much time as I can with Patty Azzarello on leadership, development, management, coaching, which she was phenomenal at. After she left HP, she would go on to kind of start her own business and benefit many leaders across the tech industry. So she's probably what I call my single most important mentor over the last decade at helping me with day-to-day management, decision-making, frameworks, strategic thinking, applying a lot of this education, experience, and skills and really formulating it and making sure you
Is that part of what you took in as far as mentoring, coaching people and really helping them?
Yeah, I do my best to cascade and translate what I've learned from her to as many as I can. It benefits me if you're working with me because it helps me move fast and be able to be effective and make decisions. It benefits them, whether they work with me or other companies. It just makes us all better. Collectively, we all get better at it. So I try to you know, preach and have that knowledge, have them read her books, sign up for her membership services, everything they can to be a part of that, because it makes them much more effective. It's made me a lot more effective.
So let's fast forward now, because you've left HP and you're in this time period before you found Doublehorn. So walk me through, you know, quickly through that and how you got where you are today.
Yeah, let me tell you about why I left HP. I'd go on to spend another 3 years, you know, with HP and be able to do all the things we set out to. And the last thing was to help launch a new business unit we did in the cloud around HP Helion. And I was given the opportunity at one time to, hey, you're now ready. But unlike Mark Hurd, when the new CEO, the current CEO took over, Meg Whitman, she was all, everybody must be in the building, right? They mean you'd be in a major office center. You know, we're going to test the warmth of the seat to see how productive people are and count cars in the parking lot. She was the opposite of Mark Hurd. And for me to move into the roles that I was striving for, I had to leave Austin. You know, and this would be probably the fifth or sixth time I've been asked to leave Austin and move to California. And my family and I are very well and happy here. My kids are in a great school, so I would decide to stay. A year prior to that, I've started missing my roots within the Austin startup, you know, venture-backed early companies. And I'd start to long for that. And I started doing more mentoring with innovators in town. I started doing more mentoring for MBA students over here. I started spending more time at different events, just trying to get myself back, because I'd been out of it for almost a decade working for these big companies, flying all over the world, you know, sending money back like a vacuum to Palo Alto. Why am I not doing this for my own community? Right. And that goes back to the Bill and Dave. You got to take care of your people, your customers, and your community. So that was hardwired into me, both in my MBA and working at HP. So I wanted to get back to my community, and I wanted to go back to working in more of the scrappier startup companies. So that's what would happen. I would leave HP and end up at a couple false starts. And after two false starts, and both of those were, I just didn't pick my boss well. I didn't pick my leader well. You know, so I said, you know, next time I'm going to go pick my boss, not my company, not my domain. So I spent about 4 months pretty much talking to and interviewing, you know, 100 or more Central Texas CEOs, founders, owners, innovators, between, you know, 10 million and 150, kind of in that sweet spot that I want to target, until I found the one that I thought that I'd want to work for and help. And that was a key thing. A lot of smart people, you know, a lot of sociopaths too. But the biggest factor is, will they let me help them? I know I can help them. You know, will they let me help them? You know, will they take advantage of my helpful nature for the right reasons? Cause it's a great bargain for them, right? It's a great ransom to have somebody who wants to help you, letting them help you. And that helped me a lot when I was talking to folks and picking my next boss, and ultimately ended up at Doublehorn, 18 months ago.
That's fantastic. So I have a couple of final questions to ask you, sort of fill in the blank. What is success to you? Success is?
Yeah. Well, so I work for my family. And that sounds strange. And I said that one time to a boss, and he thought, you're so disloyal to the company. No, he didn't get it. I'm employed by my employer, regardless of the logo, but I work for my family. And the best I can do for my family is to do my best at work, give it my best, come in every day, feet hit the ground, work hard, you know, don't waste time. Don't take it, you know, really give it my best, put my best effort into it every day on the field, playing the hardest. That's the best way I can help my company succeed. I can succeed. They'll want to employ me, you know, unless they're crazy and don't like people who help them. And then that way I can take care of my family. And it is the perfect ransom for the boss who finds the employee who has that attitude, because they're like, okay, you know, like the mafia, oh, go grab the family. He wants to take care of his family. He's going to do the best he can for his family. So he may work. And yeah, I may work 18 hours, and it takes away from my time with my family, but that's necessary to help the employer, which ultimately it all kind of levels out, amortizes out. Success comes in many forms, monetarily, psychologically. But for me, at the end of the day, my wife being able to be a full-time parent and take care of my boys having what they need from an education standpoint, both spiritual education and secular education, them having the creature comforts, not being spoiled, I hope, but having the creature comforts, and allowing me to go and do what I do best to help business or community, to take care of them, that to me is the most successful thing. It's been my attitude for a long time. It doesn't always work out financially. It's not meant to, I think. I'd love to say everything I touch, you know, would turn to gold. It's not going to, with that approach, you're going to get taken advantage of. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to follow the wrong people. It's going to happen. But at the end of the day, I can tell you through this whole process, I've been able to take care of my family very well and see them, and they make me very happy. It fills my heart with all that joy. And I think that success for me comes in being able to help and grow businesses and help them sustain my family's happiness.
Well, it's wonderful. Well, thank you for being on the show, Brent. You dropped so many wonderful gems on our audience and a lot of great insights that they can take away and I think use in their life today. So thank you again for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And you can find out more at Double Horn for Brent, and I'll leave the URL and everything in the show notes so you can follow up and check out his amazing company and see all what he's doing here in Austin.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.